abuse in those days?
You know, much like the Black Panthers and other organizations that wanted to see change, that's what MOVE was doing. That's what John Africa was about, trying to make some kind of change because of the conditions of Black people's living, and not just Black people, but poor whites and animals and the environment. We need a change. And that message was so, like, strong. And when you try to make change, when you try to do something to upset the current establishment and try to just take us in a new direction because what's happening is wrong. They don't want these things to change. They want to stay in this position of power, in this position of control. And so when anybody try to speak up, it ain't just MOVE that will run into these obstacles and in this wall of police and this wall of politicians and just trying to stop you from putting out this information. And so that's exactly what RZA was, like Donald Trump, you know, of that time, except he was even worse in that confined space.
Mike Africa Jr., we have to leave it there. I know your family will be doing something on Thursday on the anniversary of the 36 years ago, the police killing.
That's right.
11 people in the MOVE family. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Mike Africa, and Abdullah Ali Muhammad. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and/or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon State Representative Mike Nierman is arraigned on 2 misdemeanor charges in connection with allowing armed demonstrators into the state capitol last year. The Biden administration approves the nation's first major offshore wind farm. And in international news, Israel hits Gaza with airstrikes as at least 28 Palestinians, including 10 children, have been killed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 11th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Here's a reminder that today is the last day to mail in your ballot for the Multnomah County May 18, 2021 special election. Otherwise, you have until 8 p.m. on May 18th to return your ballot to a drop box. You can find a drop box near you by visiting sos.oregon.gov. Depending on where you live in Multnomah County, you'll have the chance to vote on a candidate to represent you on the Portland Public Schools Board or one of the other local district boards like David Douglas, Park Rose, Beaverton, Riverdale, Corbett, or Gresham Barlow. All Multnomah County residents can vote for candidates for the Multnomah Education Service District Board, a kind of super school board that coordinates between the different school districts in the county. Depending on where you live, you may be asked to vote on candidates for either the Portland Community College Board or the Mount Hood Community College Board. There are also a handful of races for fire and water districts for those who live on the outskirts of the county. Voters also have just one ballot measure to consider, the renewal of a 5-year funding levy for the Oregon Historical Society, which operates a museum and library focused on the state's history. The measure does not create any new fees. Rather, it is an extension of an existing levy. Today is the last day to mail in your ballot for the special election, or you have until 8 p.m. on May 18th to return your ballot to a drop box. You can find a Dropbox near you by visiting sos.oregon.gov. Oregon State Representative Mike Nierman has been arraigned on two misdemeanor charges in connection with allowing armed demonstrators into the state capitol last year. Nierman did not attend Tuesday's hearing, where a judge was set for the case and a new hearing was scheduled for June 29th. The two charges brought against Nierman are one count of first-degree official misconduct and one count of second-degree criminal trespassing. Nierman's attorney, Jason Short, would not comment on Nierman's reaction to the two charges. Nierman, a four-term Republican from Polk County, revealed last week that he had contracted a bad case of COVID-19 from which he was beginning to recover. Nierman has not attended House floor sessions in weeks and appears to have been the cause of a COVID-19-related delay in House activity in April. The criminal case against Nierman comes from a December 21st incident in which surveillance footage shows he allowed far-right demonstrators, some of them armed, to enter the Capitol while lawmakers were meeting for a special session. The group had gathered outside the Capitol to protest the building's ongoing closure to the general public due to the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the charges against him, Nierman abused his authority in allowing unauthorized people to enter the Capitol and assisted them in committing criminal trespass. The charges carry a maximum penalty of more than a year in jail and $7,500 in fines. Nierman has vowed to take the matter to trial. Nierman could also face repercussions in the legislature, where an ongoing investigation could lead to consequences such as expulsion. That would require the votes of at least three House Republicans. However, it is not clear any would support such a step. The Oregon Health Authority reported 388 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 191,774. Oregon health officials also reported three new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,533 people. There are currently 326 people hospitalized statewide, including 78 patients in intensive care units. So far, more than 49% of the state's population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 36% fully vaccinated. The University of Oregon, along with Western Oregon University, Oregon State University, and Portland State University, have announced they plan to require the COVID-19 vaccine for students this fall. Vaccinations will be required for all students and employees who either study or work in person on campus for the fall term. Governor Kate Brown said at a press conference on Tuesday that she is setting a goal of 70% for the number of Oregonians receiving a first dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Once that threshold is met, the governor said there will be no more county risk levels and a lifting of most restrictions, including capacity limits. Starting on May 21st, counties that reach 65% of its population 16 and older with a first vaccine dose and submit a plan to close the vaccine equity gap have the option to move into the lower risk category. So far, both Multnomah and Washington counties have over 60% of their eligible population vaccinated. The state will still require people to wear masks and continue social distancing until directed otherwise by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 32.7 million cases of COVID-19. At least 581,676 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 39,000 new cases reported per day, a decrease of 29% from the average 2 weeks earlier. So far, more than 46% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 35% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 158.9 million people in nearly every country. At least 3.3 million people have died across the world. The suspect in the shooting that left eight people dead at three Atlanta-area spas has been indicted on murder charges, with prosecutors seeking the death penalty for hate crimes targeting the sex and race of the victims. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis filed notice Tuesday that she plans to seek the death penalty and enhanced hate crime charges against the suspect, 21-year-old Robert Aaron Long. This will be the first test of the hate crime law passed by the Georgia legislature last year. The law specifies enhanced penalties for crimes where victims were targeted for race, gender, or sexual orientation. 7 of the victims killed in the spa shootings were women, and 6 of the victims were women of Asian descent. The enhanced hate crime penalty for homicide in Georgia is either a maximum of life in prison with the possibility of parole at 30 years, life without parole, or the death penalty. The 8 victims of the shootings were identified as 44-year-old Dayo Fang, 51-year-old Hyun Jung Grant, 69-year-old Soon Cha Kim, 54-year-old Paul Andre Michaels, 74-year-old Soon Chung Park, 49-year-old Xiaoji Tan, 33-year-old Delana Ashley Yuan, and 63-year-old Yong A. Yue. The state of Georgia is repealing its vague citizens' arrest law in the name of Ahmed Arbery. Arbery was pursued and fatally shot while jogging down a street near Brunswick, Georgia, in February of 2020. The vague citizens' arrest law is being used to defend the men in jail for his murder. Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed the repeal of the law at the Georgia State Capitol on Monday, alongside a bipartisan group of state lawmakers, as well as Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, and sister, Jasmine Arbery. Cooper Jones said, quote, "I think the state of Georgia is moving in the right direction by passing this particular bill. Unfortunately, I had to lose my son to get significant change," unquote. The vague law allowed any citizen to arrest another if a crime was committed within their immediate knowledge. It has been replaced with specific language to provide for citizen detainment in very limited circumstances, including shopkeepers who catch shoplifters and restaurant employees who witness dine and dash customers. The men in jail for Arbery's death, Travis McMichael, his father Gregory McMichael, and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan, have said they thought Arbery had committed a burglary when they chased him through the neighborhood, though no evidence of that crime has emerged. The bill's signing comes as state and federal charges against the 3 men involved in Arbery's death are moving forward. In an arraignment on Tuesday, the 3 men pleaded not guilty to the federal hate crime charges and attempted kidnapping. The father and son were also charged with using, carrying, and brandishing a firearm during a crime of violence. In the state case, which is set to go to trial in October, the 3 men are charged with malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. In an open letter on social media, Minneapolis Councilmember Philippe Cunningham says his efforts to address gun violence have been blocked by Mayor Jacob Frey and the Minneapolis Police Department. Georgia Fort has more on the story with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Ward 4 City Councilmember Philippe Cunningham is calling on Mayor Jacob Frey to come up with a plan to address the gun violence in North Minneapolis. Cunningham addressed the mayor in an open letter on social media.
I've reached a place as a council member where I can't quietly try to bring this mayor along into prioritizing Northsiders in our lives here. Instead, I needed to bring it out to the public for folks to see the kind of struggles I've been dealing with.
Cunningham says he has a responsibility to his constituents, and they deserve to know his efforts are continually roadblocked by the mayor and the Minneapolis Police Department.
This is about life or death. I've had 2 children murdered within a block of my house. Like, I live in the middle of this. We need this to be urgently addressed. We need a plan, Mayor. What is the plan?
Now, the mayor did respond to Cunningham. According to Fox 9, a part of that response said, quote, "I would encourage you to support Chief Arredondo's request for increased staffing levels moving forward." Cunningham says that's not the solution.
In no way is this asking for simply more police. When we talk about comprehensive systems of public safety, we're not just talking about reducing police violence. We're talking about reducing community violence.
Cunningham says he wants to take intel from MPD and the Office of Violence Prevention to identify key groups committing violent behavior, then provide resources to their families. Providing a way out is a strategy Cunningham says has been proven to work nationally. To view both letters in their entirety, visit racialreckoningmn.org. In Minneapolis, I'm Georgia Ford.
The Israeli bombing of Gaza continued today for the second straight day, killing 7 Palestinians and wounding 152 people. This follows a series of Israeli bombings on Monday that killed 28 Palestinians in Gaza, including 9 children. 122 Palestinians were wounded in Monday's airstrikes. Media sources said the missiles, fired from Israeli unmanned drones and from F-35 aircraft supplied by the U.S., targeted many homes, residential buildings, structures, and farmland. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that the Israeli military fired missiles into buildings adjacent to the Indonesian hospital, causing damage to the buildings and the hospital. The health ministry denounced the attack as a war crime, which violated international law by targeting medical and civilian structures. The Israeli army also fired missiles into a residential tower, causing it to collapse. Israeli sources reported that Palestinian fighters fired more than 40 shells across the border between Gaza and southern Israel, and added that the shells caused damage and injured 5 people. The Al-Qassam Brigades in Gaza warned that its retaliation will be unprecedented if Israel does not end its offensive on Gaza and does not stop its violations against the Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem, especially in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's worth mentioning that the Israeli army has decided to deploy more than 5,000 reservists across the fence with Gaza in preparation for a possible ground offensive. Tomorrow marks the final day in the holy month of Ramadan for Muslims around the world and the beginning of the 5-day celebration of Eid al-Fitr. Israeli authorities have vowed to continue their occupation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site of Islam, located in the Old City of Jerusalem. Tune in after this newscast for an interview with Palestinian professor and author Mazen Kumsia about the current escalation in Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Kumsia, who is also the founder and director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History and the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University, followed by COVID Noise Filter, Debunking COVID-19. Then at 6, It's Preference, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 79 degrees. Today in history, in 1981, Jamaican reggae legend Bob Marley dies at the age of 36. After collapsing while jogging in Central Park, Marley received a grim diagnosis. A cancerous growth on an old soccer injury on his big toe had metastasized and spread to his brain, liver, and lungs. Considered one of the pioneers of reggae, Marley passed away less than 8 months after his diagnosis. The quote of the day is from Marley's track, Redemption Song. Marley sang, quote, "Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds." The Biden administration announced on Tuesday its final approval of the nation's first commercial-scale offshore wind farm. This is a major step toward the goal of expanding renewable energy production across the U.S. The Vineyard Wind Project calls for up to 84 turbines to be installed in the Atlantic Ocean, about 12 nautical miles, off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Together, the turbines could generate around 800 megawatts of electricity, enough to power about 400,000 homes. The $2.8 billion project is a joint venture of the energy firms Avangrid Renewables and Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners. The Biden administration estimates that the project will create about 3,600 jobs. Vineyard Wind is viewed by many as a test of the administration's ability to speed up permitting offshore wind projects while navigating concerns from labor groups as well as commercial fishermen. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said, quote, "A clean energy future is within our grasp in the United States. The approval of this project is an important step toward advancing the administration's goals to create good-paying union jobs while combating climate change and powering our nation." Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the April jobs report shows more progress is needed. The Capitol Police Inspector General calls for more counterintelligence to protect Congress, and a committee considers authorizing COVID-19 vaccines for adolescents. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I believe we will reach full employment next year, but today's numbers also show that we're not yet finished.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the government's April jobs report underscores the long-haul climb back to economic recovery. While the country is seeing sustained job growth, since the pandemic, women's labor workforce participation has fallen to levels not seen since the 1980s.
Our policymaking has not accounted for the fact that people's work lives and their personal lives are inextricably linked. And if one suffers, so does the other.
U.S. Capitol Police Inspector General Michael Bolton spoke at a House committee hearing on the January 6th attack. He called for the creation of a standalone entity with a defined mission dedicated to counter-surveillance activity for Congress.
Would improve the department's ability to identify and disrupt individuals or groups intent on engaging in illegal activity.
A federal vaccine advisory committee is scheduled to meet this week to discuss whether to recommend Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for adolescents. FDA advisory committee member Dr. Paul Offit says there is now abundant evidence children's vaccines are safe and effective. He talked about a recent Pfizer clinical trial of 2,300 children aged 12 to 15. One group received the vaccine. The other received a placebo.
The vaccines induced excellent immune responses, were safe. There were 18 cases of COVID in that study, all in the placebo group.
He also said the 10-day pause of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine shows the CDC and FDA are committed to transparency and are prioritizing safety, but acknowledged the standstill has damaged the overall goals of getting most Americans vaccinated.
I think we didn't do a very good job early on of explaining relative risks because I think people don't understand relative risks.
Some lawmakers are also discussing how to modernize Congress. Washington State Democratic Representative Derek Kilmer, co-head of the Modernization of Congress Committee, says encouraging bipartisanship is a priority.
How do we change some of the norms and culture within Congress to foster more collaboration so that it's not just sort of persistently the Hatfields and McCoys?
It's National Women's Health Week, and a new survey finds many women feel they're in the dark about basic health risk factors. Andrea Clements of the National Primary Care Doctor Network, MDVIP, says 9 in 10 women are unaware heart disease is the leading cause of death in women.
This is worrisome as a physician because there are other things we learned that women are more concerned about cancer and arthritis than they are about heart disease, and heart disease is the number one killer of women.
A recent survey found a majority of women don't know consuming alcohol increases breast cancer risk. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
The United Nations gets involved in a fisheries dispute in Canada. Indigenous groups criticize the federal handling of missing and murdered Indigenous persons cases, and the Treasury Department announces a plan for tribal COVID-19 funding. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The United Nations is getting involved in a fisheries dispute on Canada's east coast. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a UN committee is to consider a complaint of racism against the Canadian government by Native fishers in Nova Scotia.
A United Nations Committee on Racial Discrimination wants to hear what the Canadian government has to say about the allegations. The charge is that it committed racist actions in its treatment of Mi'kmaq lobster fishers, and Canada's permanent representative to the UN is being asked to respond. The Sipik-Nakadak First Nation argues that it has a right to a moderate livelihood when and where its members wish, based on a ruling from Canada's Supreme Court. But Ottawa says that moderate livelihood must take place within the commercial fishing season. Last year, violence erupted against native fishers, a lobster pound was destroyed, and a band member's van was set on fire. Chief Mike Sachs says he doesn't want that to happen this year.
We're going to send a letter off to the United Nations and hoping that they can come and keep the peace. And it was very obvious to me that we couldn't rely on the RCMP or DFO.
The Department of Fisheries and Oceans says closed lobster seasons are there for conservation purposes. Talks with the Sipik-Nakadak band broke down earlier this year. The First Nation says it's planning to resume a self-regulated lobster season in June, outside of the federal seasons. The UN says it's looking at allegations that the RCMP failed to take appropriate measures to prevent acts of violence and to protect the fishers and their properties from being vandalized. It wants to know what the Canadian government has done to deal with the allegations of racism. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Nearly 30 Indigenous advocacy groups are condemning the work of a presidential task force on missing and murdered Indigenous person cases. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports.
On National Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day, the groups issued a statement on Operation Lady Justice, claiming the presidential task force established in 2019 has been, quote, continuously inflicting harm on MMIWG and MMIP families and showing disrespect to the movement, end quote. The statement says no significant outreach was done to engage with impacted families and grassroots advocates, and an inadequate number of task force listening sessions were scheduled.
I'm so sorry if you hear my dogs barking in the background.
Anita Lucchesi is the executive founding director of Sovereign Bodies Institute, an Indigenous-led research nonprofit that maintains a large database of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Lucchesi was a guest last Wednesday on a panel providing updates on the case of Kaysera Stops Pretty Places, a Crow and Northern Cheyenne teenager whose body was found in Hardin, Montana in 2013.
But it's frustrating that every year we mark this day and every year families are in the same boat they were the year before. And that's just unacceptable. There's something critically wrong with our justice system if families of missing and murdered Native people are in the same position they were a year ago.
Advocacy groups say no meaningful action has come of the federal cold case review teams created in November 2019, and MMIP family members and advocates have not yet been provided a point of contact with the task force. The White House issued a statement on May 5th committing to allocate more resources and work with tribal nations to address the MMIP crisis. The Biden administration has not publicly responded to the statement. In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
The U.S. Treasury Department Monday announced the formula for the $20 billion set aside for tribes in the American Rescue Plan to help recover from the pandemic. In a letter and briefing with tribal leaders, the department laid out a timeline, funding formula, and requirements. The plan includes sharing $1 billion equally. The Treasury Secretary will determine how to allocate the rest. Distribution will be based on self-certified tribal enrollment or employment data. Two payments will be made to eligible tribal governments. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jenka Soderberg, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Georgia Fort, Antonia Gonzalez, and Nadia Romlagon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, featuring art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. Then at 10, it's the Children's Hour, educational and entertaining programming for listeners of all ages. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO's currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Kumsia about the current escalation in Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined today by Mazen Kumsia, who is a professor at Bethlehem University and is the founder of the Palestinian Natural History Museum, as well as the author of a number of books, including Sharing the Land of Canaan, Popular Resistance in Palestine. Professor Kumsia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on this, Jenk.
Now, you have shared a statement on Sunday about the Jerusalem uprising. Since then, there have been a number of developments, including the bombing of Gaza. Could you just fill our listeners in on what the current situation is now in Palestine?
Well, to put it briefly and in context, of course, we have colonial occupation. And colonialism requires violence, so the colonialists always use violence against the native people. In this case, the idea of Zionism was to transform a country that's multi-religious, multi-ethnic, and multicultural and make it the Jewish state of Israel. So Palestine and its people, of course, resisted this, and that's natural. Colonialism requires violence. And the native, you know, because you cannot come to somebody's home and land and ask them nicely to leave, so you have to use violence to create the system. And we in the U.S., of course, were familiar with that history of the U.S. In this situation, you know, Palestinians are 13 million people. 7.5 million of us are refugees or displaced people. And so resistance to this process of ethnic cleansing is natural. And what's happening in the past month or so is put in that context because Israel wants to ethnically cleanse 28 families from Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
And you have documented Palestinian nonviolent resistance over the decades of the Israeli occupation. I wonder if you can just share how the Palestinians have resisted nonviolently, particularly in Sheikh Jarrah and in Jerusalem, where the current situation has been focused.
I mean, Zionism as a process and as an ideology entails the removal of people from their land and the creation of a new reality. That's what colonialism is about. The process of the local people sticking to their lands, even staying at their homes, that's considered resistance. So for us, resistance is every aspect of retention of the native people on their land. And that can take hundreds of forms, civil disobedience, boycotts, lobbying, protests, etc. But ultimately, they all fall under the category of basically what we call in Arabic sumud. Sumud is a sort of a combination of resilience and resistance. Because again, you know, the goal of the oppressor is to remove the people from their land, and the goal of the people is to remain on their land and to remain in their homes, and that's all we want, is to be in our country without somebody coming to ethnically cleanse us, because they have this oppressor has a notion that God gave them the land or that they are superior to, etc. Colonial mentalities are similar around the world.
In Sheikh Jarrah, this is where a Palestinian neighborhood has been besieged in recent years, in that the Israeli military, along with Israeli settlers, have worked together to displace the Palestinians that live there. What is the purpose of Israel displacing Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah? I understand it's part of a plan to push Palestinians out of most of East Jerusalem, and this is just one aspect.
Yeah, I mean, Israel, when it was created in 1948, it ethnically cleansed West Jerusalem of its Palestinian population, Christian and Muslim, and made it a pure Jewish area, the Western Jerusalem area. Then in 1967, which is 19 years later after 1948, Israel occupied the rest of Jerusalem, illegally per international law, by the way, international law says Israel has no rights in Jerusalem, period, end of story. But anyway, they occupied the other part of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, in 1967, and proceeded to ethnically cleanse people and to settle Jewish population gathered from around the world into this area of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. So many neighborhoods of Jerusalem were already taken, basically. Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan were the only two neighborhoods that are close to the old city that were still Palestinian, if you want, and outside of the city wall. And so these neighborhoods came into the crosshairs of the Zionist colonizers. As the last blocks to be made Jewish, if you want. And so that's the reason they have become such a flashpoint, because Israel sees them as the last, blocks to be Judaized, as they say, to become Jewish. So that's what is happening, and why Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan are under pressure at this point.
Their location would enable a kind of an encircling of the old city of Jerusalem.
The ring of settlements around the old city, isolating it from the rest of Palestine, the rest of the West Bank. This is the whole intention. It's to make Jerusalem all Jewish. And they're not, hiding this. Even on the Jerusalem Municipality website, the Jewish Jerusalem Municipality website, it says that they aim to make a Jewish population of Jerusalem 75% or more. So obviously, since the Palestinian population that remains in Jerusalem is about 33%, it used to be 60%, but anyways, since now it's 33%, it has to be shrunk, basically. And Sheikh Jarrah families are part of this trimming of the Palestinian population in Jerusalem.
Where are they expected to go? I mean, are the Palestinians who are displaced able to remain in Jerusalem? Do they lose their Jerusalem residency? Do they have to move to the West Bank?
Yeah, that's the thing. They don't have a place to go, basically. And, this is not unusual. I mean, that's why we have dozens of refugee camps, even inside Palestine. Many Palestinians also are not in refugee camps, but they have been displaced from their homes and live with relatives in the remaining ghettos that are left for the Palestinians, like the Bethlehem or the Ramallah or the Gaza ghetto. So that's the whole idea. And then there's the refugee camps outside of Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, etc. As I mentioned, 7.5 million Palestinians are refugees or displaced people. Ironically, many of these people, including some of the families in Sheikh Jarrah, have been displaced more than once. For example, there are families like Al Kurd family in Sheikh Jarrah who come from Haifa or Jaffa, one of those two major Palestinian cities that were ethnically cleansed in 1948. So, the same with the Jahalin Bedouins who were displaced from the Naqab, the Negev, into the Jordan Valley and then were displaced from the Jordan Valley up the hills to the Jerusalem wilderness areas or Jerusalem desert. And now Israel wants to displace them a third time or make them refugees a third time. So this is what's happening, and that's why we have a problem. It is the problem with the Western media, of course, is they concentrate on a particular symptom of the problem, like a Palestinian throwing a stone at Israeli soldiers in the middle of Al-Aqsa compound, the third holiest site of Islam, and they make this as, look at Palestinian violence, you know? Well, sorry, but colonial situations always have these symptoms, and you have to look at colonialism as a violence, because it is, and 100,000 Palestinians have been killed since the start of this Zionist project in Palestine.
This kind of might makes right foreign and domestic policy that Israel is imposing was supposed to be made illegal after World War II under international law, the Geneva Conventions, that a nation couldn't just take over neighboring land and consider it their own land by using military force. How is it that that Israel is able to do this with impunity? And are there steps that are being taken internationally to prevent this kind of might makes right from continuing?
Yes, I think it is important to understand why international law is not being obeyed in this case. There is a problem here that was not faced as in South Africa under apartheid. South Africa under apartheid, the Afrikaner white minority government didn't have a lobby that's functioning strongly in Western countries, pushing an agenda and controlling the mainstream media in a way that gives them the, you know, flips things on end and makes the victims look like they're the oppressors. This is what's happening in Western media today, as I mentioned earlier, and the way that they function. That's number one, is the control of many aspects of mainstream media that makes it flips the reality and doesn't want to give any aspects of the truth of what's happening here. When anybody who comes here, and of course, can see the reality very obviously. The second aspect is, of course, the Western governments, which are hypocritical. They said there's international law and human rights, but they supported apartheid and racism in South Africa, as they are supporting apartheid and racism in Palestine. And one doesn't have to be a genius if you watch, for example, the last press conference held in the State Department with the U.S. spokesperson who's wiggling, trying to answer simple questions like, do Palestinians have a right to self-defense or only Israel has a right to self-defense? Then he wouldn't answer. You know, and then ask another question from a reporter. Do you condemn the killing of Palestinian civilians, children in the streets that are being killed? And he again, he refuses to answer, tries to wiggle out to it. And then the U.S. Yesterday at the U.N. Security Council meeting, again, the U.S. defends Israel and uses its veto power when it feels necessary to protect Israel from international law, and continues to be a partner in crime because obviously the U.S. funds the oppression to the tune of about $4 billion of U.S. taxpayer money every single year, about $12, $15 million every single day.
And what would you suggest for people who are appalled at this kind of treatment of Palestinians? Is the legislation being promoted by Rashida Tlaib something that people can support and get behind? And the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement? Are those things that you would recommend for people who want to put pressure on the Israeli government to adhere to international law?
We've been historically in these situations, and always, if we remember from the civil rights movement or from struggle against oppression in South Africa or in Nazi Germany, etc., the idea was that, you know, when you are neutral in situations of injustice, you are taking the side of the oppressor. So people need to act, and they can act, and there are hundreds of ways to act, from, media work, to publicity, to writing to social media, to writing to politicians, putting politicians to the test and explaining to them, do you support human rights or you don't support human rights? And do Palestinians have human rights? Why can't you support this basic human right of people to live in their own land and not be ethnically cleansed? So telling the truth and engaging in boycott, divestment, sanctions, and pressuring the government and our friends and publicizing. These are all things that can be done, protests in your communities, educating your fellow citizens. This is classical civil rights kind of approaches that we encourage people to engage in.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for joining us on KBOO. Professor Mazen Kumsiya joining us from Bethlehem, and he is a professor at Bethlehem University, author of several books. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO Radio.
My name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
National Nurses Week begins each year on May 6th and ends on May 12th, Florence Nightingale's birthday. The nursing profession has been supported and promoted by the American Nurses Association, the ANA, since 1896. Nurse Julia, what is the theme for this year's Nurses Week?
So, the American Nurse Association Enterprise joins the World Health Organization and global colleagues in extending the Year of the Nurse into 2021. This recognition built on the increased visibility of nurses' contributions from 2020 and ANA's expansion of National Nurses Week to Nurses Month in May. So in light of this national holiday, this week on COVID Noise Filter, we'll be honoring nurses all week long. Nurses burnout and technology. Nurses have experienced a large brunt of the pandemic firsthand. As frontline workers, many nurses have faced burnout in the face of the challenges the pandemic has brought. One survey of 226 nurses found that 61% reported emotional and physical fatigue, and the influence of technology can either help or hurt nurses' well-being, depending on the medium.
IT, or information technology, has been a source of burnout for many nurses. For example, the system of electronic health records may not be so user-friendly and can cause deeper frustration when it does not function properly for a nurse. Additionally, click fatigue. Oy, I know about click fatigue. Click fatigue has been a cause for more stress. This refers to the never-ending clicking nurses must do in updating charts with each detail and change in a patient's status. Now, it is crucial for nurses to provide a detailed summary of a patient's status. However, the increasing screen time that they've experienced has caused harm to their well-being. A nurse states, when these systems require so many boxes to be checked and screens to be confirmed, it can undermine our time and focus on patient care.
Another phenomenon which has surfaced is alarm fatigue. During a shift, several patient alarms will go off and the nurse must be on alert and ready to respond. These alarms have antiquated technology and can often go off as a false alarm. One nurse explains, you continue to ask yourself, do I have to go running to make sure my patient is safe, or is it a false alarm? The frequent occasion of alarms going off over and over, day after day, can add to the load of burnout experienced by nurses.
So we have to ask ourselves, what can be done to reduce technological stress? One helpful IT development is speech recognition services for charting patients. This helps reduce the redundancy of having to manually re-enter the information discussed. Additionally, antiquated technology services such as patient alarms can be upgraded to provide more reliability.
Another tool is to implement supportive resources for nurses such as meditation or mindfulness activities. All in all, technology is not inherently detrimental to nurses' health and well-being, but it must continue to adapt to the circumstances and become a useful tool for nurses rather than merely increasing their burnout and stress.
So for you, Julia, tell me about how technology, as you read this story, were you able to relate with some of this?
Absolutely. It's the alarms for me. I think as nurses, we all have experienced, you know, a phenomenon where you get home and you're trying to quiet yourself and wind down from your day. And sure enough, you think that the alarm was in the room with you and you hear this beeping, you know, like you're looking around like, whoa, you know, it just is always part of your background noise, so to speak. But one thing that I definitely thought about when you mentioned, you know, checking the boxes and all of the charting, my first thought was, well, you know, going back to paper charting definitely isn't an option. So we know where that's not headed, but right. But yeah, it is a real thing. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I hope that I think we're about 10 plus years of electronic medical records. And I think that we're at a point now where we understand them and that we understand where are the places that we can decrease that burden of technological stress on our nurses. So I think this is a great story, and I hope that folks will continue to monitor this and make sure that we do whatever we can to, again, celebrate our nurses, not only here during Nurses Week, but every day should be Nurses Day. Every week should be Nurses Week. And whatever we can do to help decrease that stress, I think, is incredibly important. Study results on nurse resilience. Okay, so now in March of this year, a study was conducted to review the effectiveness of coping strategies on nurses' resilience to stress. Now, the study included 43 nurses and documented qualitative data on their daily personal experiences. Now, nurses in the study also responded to a numerical brief resiliency coping scale, which measures coping mechanisms. Oh, all right.
The BRCS included four statements, and nurses were asked to rank them for each experience scenario. The first, I look for creative ways to alter difficult situations. Second, regardless of what happens to me, I believe I can control my reaction to it. Third, I believe I can grow in positive ways by dealing with difficult situations. And fourth, I actively look for ways to replace the losses I encounter in life.
The study found that nurses demonstrate medium scores on the BRCS with an average of about 14.1. The qualitative data revealed both certainty and uncertainty in their responses. So let me give you an example. A statement of uncertainty would be, what is the protocol today? And certainty would be, proud to be a nurse. Now, the researchers concluded that the nurses they studied are medium resilient copers, falling along the middle of the spectrum with room to improve. On the other hand, there exists the difficulty of coping with the incredible challenging circumstances of the incredible pandemic. So, Julia, maybe you can talk to us a bit about some of the examples of resilience and coping mechanisms that you experienced. I know that's not necessarily something that you always like to talk about, but I know that you did go to New York at the peak of the pandemic when New York was really experiencing their pandemic. And again, I don't mean to embarrass you, put you on the spot, but I know it was very, very busy for you at the time. What were some of the coping mechanisms and resilience strategies you used at that time?
Well, for me, it was very important that I wind down after each shift. We had very early mornings and late evenings, the upwards of a 14 and even 15 hour day sometimes, because we'd have to load up on buses to be shuttled across town to the various hospitals. So needless to say, my days were extremely long. So it was very important for me when I got home, it almost became ritualistic for me to meditate after a shower and journal and do things to actually release and wind down. And the evening was very short, you know, after getting home after nine sometimes. So there wasn't much time to do a whole lot, but it was important, like I said, to meditate and journal and pray and speak to family. You know, FaceTime was a huge release for me, being away from home, but just to be able to see my family and talk to them and my friends as well. So those are some of the things that were extremely helpful for me. But I just like to add that, you know, even prior to the pandemic, burnout wasn't a new concept. Obviously, you know this, Dr. Derry, burnout in healthcare isn't new by any means. But I do think that the pandemic did a really great job of exposing the fragility of healthcare workers, not just nurses. I think everyone was under a large degree of fire, and it really showed gaps in ways that we as healthcare professionals can better take care of ourselves, and also administrations can do a better job of incorporating activities for coping. I know at the hospital that I was in the Bronx, they actually created a room that was dedicated to winding down. So lots of nurses would come during their break and sit in the relaxing chairs. There would be soft music and aromatherapy and snacks and things like that to really kind of cultivate a sense of well-being.
Well, let me just say this, although I'm sure you probably hear this regularly, I just want to go on record of saying here, on behalf of the whole Noise Filter family, we honor you, Nurse Julia. We celebrate you, Nurse Julia, for the amazing work, not only that you have done in your career, but certainly all that you did for New York City at the peak of the pandemic. And thank you so much. We're so grateful to have you on our show.
Managing nurse burnout. On a normal given day, nursing is a very stressful and one of the toughest jobs out there. Now, add a global pandemic. You can't even imagine the added stress that it brought to nurses across the world.
Oh boy, are you right, Julia. Now, nurses are facing huge burnout rates and high levels of anxiety. It is even often associated with staff shortages, long hours, and the stress that can come from caring for really, really sick patients, especially those that are infected with COVID. Now, before COVID, the burnout rate amongst nurses was around 40%. As of January 2021, Nurse Julia, it's around 70%. COVID has added emotional trauma with its uncertainty and infectiousness.
Yeah, nurses have experienced it all. There was not much known about COVID. There were limited resources such as PPE, treatment, and vaccines, and there was minimal government intervention to help mitigate the spread.
That's right. Many nurses had to ration care due to the high number of cases. Many have felt guilty for working with people infected with COVID and perhaps unknowingly infecting others. Now, because of this line of work, many nurses themselves became infected with COVID-19. Medical staff went from being praised to ostracized or even criticized by certain groups of people. But certainly, one of the biggest tolls was having to watch hundreds of people die every day.
So, to my fellow nurses out there, take care of yourself and your mental health. If you are physically and emotionally exhausted, if you have a decreased interest or empathy in your patients and coworkers, And if you're feeling inadequate, you may be burnt out and you may need a break, some sleep, or some other type of support. It's important that you take care of your burnout so it does not lead to something worse.
Holly Way, who's an associate professor at the East Carolina University's College of Nursing, recommends addressing three specific areas to help address burnout. One, create meaning in what you do. Two, connect with both physical and psychological energy sources. This ranges from exercise to sleep to diet to even finding support or even social connections. Three, work on your own self-compassion. Find your self-value and limitations. Forgive yourself for the things that you do that you think that you didn't do right. I'm telling you, as a healthcare professional for over 25 years, I am plagued with those thoughts. And I think forgiving myself is such an important thing to do. And I ask that you do that as well. Nurse Julia?
There are many other activities to help reduce stress. Whatever it is, just make sure you do it. You need to take good care of yourself in the same way you've been taking care of others. Happy Nurses Week.
Happy Nurses Week. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Show your support for KBOO today by becoming a member. Just text KBOO to the phone number 44321 and join the thousands of members who make volunteer-powered radio possible. KBOO.